The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. This is Mike Consul, your host. My guest is Richard Fluor. He is a partner of Cross Harbor Capital Partners and a portfolio manager for the firm's debt strategies, where he focuses on financing multifamily and industrial opportunities. I know what you're thinking. Could he have picked two better property types, two more solid and sure property types? They're the two major property types that have been really considered the property types of the year for years running. You know, on the multifamily front, we have a severe housing shortage in this country. We need many more units built. On the industrial side, we could be talking reshoring, nearshoring, e-commerce, last mile facilities, and the product delivery mandates that have fueled the sector, such as same day delivery and so on. But what about the money required to do so? Let's explore that. Richard Fluor, welcome to the program.
Mike, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It's good to have you. You know, money is the mother's milk, not only of politics, but of business. And you got a stash of it. We're going to talk about what exactly you do with that money and how investors profit from that. Let me get a little bit more of your background. I had kind of a short bio on you. How long have you been in the debt slash credit business and the real estate business overall?
Well, let's see. I started my career in real estate about almost 40 years ago. It hurts me to say that. I spent, prior to joining Cross Harbor, where I joined 6 years ago, I spent 28 years of Prudential, now PGIM, where I started on the equity side and did a number of different things for them, ran a REIT that was publicly listed. And then I transitioned to the debt side about 30 years ago and really haven't looked back. And it was a great run at Prudential. I had never thought I would be there as long as I was there, but they kept offering me different things to do. And then I joined Cross Harbor in 2018 to kind of launch our dedicated senior lending strategies. And happy to tell you that that's worked out very well. And it's been great.
Well, good to hear. I suspect, though, the most important thing on your resume is that you've attended 100 or more Bruce Springsteen concerts. Is my figure accurate?
Definitely accurate. I have. Now, again, if I've been in the business for 40 years, you can kind of do some math and figure out how old I am. But I grew up in the New York area, and, you know, Springsteen was a legend going back, and it was not uncommon for him to play 10 nights at the Garden. And if you were a fan, you'd go for the shows because they were all different. So I am a lifelong fan and actually took my family to Europe to see him twice last year. So definitely a passion of mine.
And wow.
It's sort of like one of the very few things you can do that still feels like it did when you were 18. You know, a Springsteen concert then and a Springsteen concert now, a little different. He doesn't run around as much, but it's sort of a lot the same. So anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, there's a few bands that really, I know a lot of people who have been to many Springsteen shows, and then there's a Grateful Dead where people have been to many, many shows. There's also a band called Fish. Are you also a Fish fan by any chance or not?
I am. I like Fish. Don't get me wrong. And was, like I said, old enough, I saw the Dead in concert and it was interesting, but it's not the same type of energy that a Springsteen show has. Doesn't mean it's not good, and it doesn't mean, you know, different people like different things, but you know, let's just say the recreational drugs you need to take for a Dead or a Fish show are different than what you would need for a Springsteen show.
Yeah, all you need is some good caffeine for Bruce Springsteen show, and
exactly.
Yeah, you're an Asbury Park guy. Okay. So let's get to real estate. I just pigeonholed you into multifamily and industrial. And as I said, not a bad place to be, really good property types. But are there any other commercial real estate property types where you see solid opportunities for credit today or that you play in? Or are you strictly multifamily and industrial at this stage?
No, we play across the spectrum, all the different property types. And there's definitely opportunities. I think right now, you know, you could find some interesting opportunities in the hospitality sector and perhaps even the retail sector. You have to just be careful, just because it's hard to paint with a broad brush, right? I mean, for every one good retail deal you might find, there's probably 10 that aren't good. And you can probably say the same thing about hospitality, maybe not quite as severe a ratio. But we've done office lending, we frankly have done it all. And as you pointed out in your kind of introductory remarks, industrial and multifamily have been sort of, the favorite food group for quite some time. I will tell you that, across Harbor, we were early adapters of that. And my own personal experience with industrial, that was actually where how I learned the real estate business, is on the industrial side, on the equity side. And I sort of kind of fell in love with that sector because, frankly, it's the simplest. It's four walls, a roof, and a floor.
Yeah, it goes up fast. It goes up fast. I mean, when you got into other property types, didn't you say, like, what is taking so long? I mean, come on, we slap up an industrial place in 3 months, four walls and a roof, and cut out some doors and windows. Did you find it frustrating at all? I mean, let's face it, a lender comes up with the money because the market's right. And you take so long to build it. Now, all of a sudden, the market there, that submarket, let's say, is not so right. Industrial doesn't have that same problem, correct?
Well, you're 100% right. I mean, I think what you're kind of alluding to is the cycle risk, right? I mean, if you're building a 60-story office building, it could take 3 years. And from the time you start the project, which may be a brilliant idea and a wonderful time, to the time you finish it, it may be a different world. As you point out, industrial, I mean, it could take 6 months, and that may be a long time from the time you start building it to the time it's done. The cycle risk is minimized. And the other part that always appealed to me about industrial, and I think sometimes not just lenders lose sight of this, but real estate investors lose sight of this, and it's in focus today for sure, is that the cost of re-tenanting an industrial building is a coat of paint. And honestly, if the market's soft, you might have to put two coats of paint on. Whereas the cost of re-tenanting an office building, I mean, the sky's the limit. And in today's environment, that is becoming abundantly clear to people who are trying to lease up office buildings in a marketplace where there's clearly less demand.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned office because I did want to mention to you that whether you guys are playing in office right now. I mean, I heard New York City developer Bruce Ratner today on CNBC say that office is in terrible trouble and it is not coming back. True?
No, not true. And I'm not gonna tell you, I know more than Bruce Ratner. I don't. What I can tell you is, we don't know how this story ends, right? We don't know. What I can say for certain is, office isn't going away. It's not like typewriters, right? I mean, typewriters, they're obsolete. Office buildings will not be obsolete, but the way we use them is going to be different. And as a result, we don't really know who the winners are going to be and who the losers are going to be. That's starting to come into focus now. But then the other part is, even if you're smart enough to figure that out, it's hard to know what the income stream an office building throws off is worth. That's honestly one of the biggest challenges, because it's starting to become clear there's certain office buildings and markets that are going to be obsolete, and they're going to be obsolete relatively soon. And that means there's going to be less supply, and there will be some semblance of, which buildings are good buildings and which will never be an office building again. The question is going to be the cost of leasing them up, the income you're going to generate from leasing them up, and then what's that income stream going to be worth? And right now, nobody knows the answer to that. And that may be what Bruce Ratner is alluding to, but I cannot imagine for a moment that he thinks that we will never use office buildings again.
He was dismal on it. I have to say that. Now, let me ask you then about are you lending on office currently?
No,
You're not right now. You're looking for the shakeout. You want this thing to shake out maybe and get a clearer view on what's going to work and what isn't.
absolutely. And just to be clear, I don't think that we're afraid to be leaders and to be first movers. And as it relates to office, the challenge is just the uncertainty around what is the income stream going to be worth, and ultimately, what is it going to cost to tenant and potentially re-tenant that building? And nobody knows the answer to that. Until someone does, it's going to be very challenging to invest in that sector, but we will get an answer to it. It's not like it's a never going to happen thing. It's just going to take longer than everybody wants.
So let's get back to real estate more broadly. There is, of course, the since COVID, certain property types were hit really hard. Obviously, office, and it sounds like office might, this is going to be a continuing adjustment for office. Hotels, not so much. Hotels have come back in a big way, and it's not cheap to stay at hotels these days. Everybody wants to travel. But if you look at the whole, spectrum of real estate, one of the new factors is is inflation and higher interest rates. Talk about with inflation, you've got lease rates, hotel being the best example of it's so dynamic they can change their prices hour to hour based on availability and inflation and what have you. What impact is inflation having? And then also speak to interest rates because. Well, because you've been to 100 Bruce Springsteen concerts, I know that you have lived long enough, like I have, to have seen interest rates that make us say, "What is everybody freaking out about? These are not crazy interest rates. They used to be crazy, and are not. These are not crazy." And in fact, there are people who argue that it's a good thing that they're higher because people were promiscuous with the money before because it was so cheap. So, what impact is inflation and interest rates having on new construction?
So first, I like the way you frame that, and especially reaffirming my age. That was very clever. But the thing I would say is, let's start with interest rates, right? If you go back 65 years, go back to 1960, even I wasn't alive back then. And I've asked this question at presentations I've given to the audience, and the questions I always start with the first question: Are we in a high interest rate environment today, or a low interest rate environment today? And almost everybody raises high interest rate environment. That's how they raise their hands. And it's okay. What's the average 10-year treasury over that 65-year period? And people will sometimes guess 4%, 4.5%, but the actual answer is 5.9%. Over that 65-year period, it's almost 6%. So if you look at where the 10-year is today relative to where it's been over that period, we're in a low interest rate environment. It just doesn't feel low because we got so used to having close to zero interest rates. I think we're sort of in a normalized rate environment. I don't think we're ever going to see, a 1.5% 10-year again in my lifetime, but I also don't think we're going to see a 12% 10-year either. I think we're starting to see people come to the conclusion that, somewhere around a 3.5 to a 5% 10 years normal, and that means that cap rates are going to be higher than they were 3 years ago. And unfortunately, it's just going to be painful and take time. As it relates to inflation, I think you alluded to this with hotels, that hotels can reset their rates every day. So top line revenue, inflation is good, and people have always viewed real estate as sort of an inflationary hedge. The thing that I think is a little different this time is that expenses are growing in many instances faster than revenue, and that's a problem, right? Because that means that your real income is actually either not growing or worse, decreasing. So you combine that with the uncertainty around interest rates and cap rates, it becomes very, very challenging to know how much a property is worth today. I think once we get more comfort on where interest rates settle, we'll have more courage around our convictions about cap rates, and hopefully that will also coincide with some stability around costs, so we can feel more certain about what the income is today and what it will be in the future, which will then allow us to value real estate with more confidence than we currently have the ability to do today.
Well, given all that, it wouldn't surprise me if Cross Harbor Capital has revised its lending requirements given the environment. Is that the case, or have you held steady?
So I think that I would say to you, we haven't revised our requirements. We've taken a different tack in our approach. And by that, I mean, we're lending less today than we were 2 or 3 years ago because we can, because the banks have largely pulled back from the sector. There's much less capital from a debt perspective in the real estate industry. And that allows those of us who have capital to drive terms a little bit more. So we can lend less and charge more. We can get better covenants for performance. all things that were challenging to do back in 21, when, when we look back, we're going to say 21 was a peak or, sort of a little bit of a bubble. Lenders had much less pricing power back then. Money was very much more commoditized. Today, where our approach is, we're going to lend less on the same quality real estate, and we're going to charge more, which is a really good thing for our investors.
Now, what market conditions do you look for when considering a construction loan? What are the what boxes have to be checked for you to say, okay, it's a go?
That's a great question. So I'd love to tell you there's this an enormously complex algorithm that we've built that, is proprietary and only we have the answers to it. But the answer is actually much simpler. It's sort of like follow the people, follow the jobs. If you follow where the markets where you see population growth and job growth, you're going to come across where you need new construction, right? We have a housing shortage in this country. That's not very controversial. And when you have markets where people are moving to, where there's already a housing shortage, you need more housing. So that makes it kind of a little simpler to figure out where you want to build new multifamily product. Now, if more people are moving there, that means they need more goods. And if they need more goods, you need more places to store the goods. That means that that's going to be kind of a positive for industrial construction as well. So when we look at the markets, we're tracking population growth and job growth, and we're looking for the ones that we believe will perform the best, I'll say, over the next 3 to 5 years.
So for the investor out there who wants to take that ride, get into debt investing, and we hear that the equation or the ratio between debt and equity, it has changed. People are edging more and more to the debt side. Yeah, there's good companies. Yes, there's funds that sound good. There's good property types. But ultimately, and you check me on this, ultimately, it really has to do with who's the portfolio manager. And is he or she a winner? Now you're a portfolio manager, so I'm going to presume that you are a very effective portfolio manager, Richard. What characteristic or characteristics do you possess that you would say any portfolio manager needs these characteristics if they're going to win the faith of investors and actually deliver for them?
So the answer I'd love to give is you want a portfolio manager who's seen the most Bruce Springsteen shows possible. The more you see, the better you're going to be. Unfortunately, I don't know that that correlation is really going to translate to investors. But I think you want experience, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be, 100 years old, but you have to understand that trees don't grow to the sky. And when times are really, really good, it's very easy to be a lender. When times are challenging, it's still easy to be a lender. I know that sounds silly because it's challenging, but lending money is the easy part. Getting paid back's the hard part. So you want a portfolio manager who understands the difference between what a judicial state is for foreclosure and a non-judicial state. You want a portfolio manager who understands that when times go bad, how can you structure it up front to maximize the value of your investment? And that frankly comes from experience, which I think, again, at Cross Harbor, we pride ourselves in the length of tenure that we have and how closely we work together as a team. It doesn't mean that other companies don't have it. It just means you ask for something like that, what's a critical ingredient in kind of making the determination of, who's going to be outperforming and who's going to maybe subperform. And I think experience is certainly one thing. And then the other part is vision, right? There's a great quote from Wayne Gretzky because someone asked him when he was playing how he thought he was so much better than everybody else because he clearly was. And his answer was relatively simple. It was because I go to where the puck is going to be. And the implication there is if you go to where the puck is right at that moment, by the time you get there, the puck won't be there anymore. So you want someone who hopefully has the ability to see where the puck is going. And I think that's what we have demonstrated with our industrial and multifamily construction lending program. We were early, early, early adapters to understanding that industrial was in short supply and you could get paid incredibly well relative to the risk you were taking. for industrial construction lending. And we've demonstrated that. Now others have sort of kind of come to that conclusion as well. Maybe not as many as you would think, but that vision allowed our investors to capitalize and earn very, very outsized returns. So again, going back to answer your question, experience and vision would be the two critical ingredients, along with Springsteen. That's a given.
There we go. 10th Avenue freeze out there. Okay. What is an acceptable default rate? Obviously, you don't want anybody to default. But for instance, hotels, I got to have 85% occupancy or greater. I can live with 85%. Is it a 2% default rate, a 5% default rate that's within acceptable bandwidth or what?
So I think you're asking a good question, but in answering the question, I think there's two components, right? It's not just the default, but it's the severity of loss that occurs once something has defaulted. And by that, I mean, you could have a low default percentage in an asset class. And I'll pick office, for example. Now, obviously, the default rate's much higher. But the severity of loss you would experience with an office building is much greater than you would with an apartment building. So you can't just look at the default rate. You have to look at the combination of default and severity of loss. And that leads you to the asset classes that have sort of the least intensiveness of capital, which would be multifamily and industrial. Because as I mentioned, industrial tenant improvements consist of, a coat of paint and, if you're generous, some carpet. And multifamily, there's not this concept of, spending tons of money to re-tenant buildings, apartment properties. So that to me means those two asset classes have less inherent risk than a hotel, for example, and certainly an office building. So you mentioned about an acceptable default rate. I think you have to measure default rate with severity of loss, and that leads you to industrial and multifamily. And the succinct answer to your question is, what's acceptable? Zero. That's what everybody should be shooting for. Now, that doesn't mean that you won't have defaults. Ideally, if you do have the default, that gives you the opportunity as a lender to take back the asset. And one thing we know over time is that if you can take back an asset that is good real estate and weather the storm, that asset will be worth more than your loan one day. And that, to me, is, you mentioned earlier the criteria of a good portfolio manager. I would say the criteria of a good lender is someone who has that expertise and has the ability to weather the storm, because I am certain that at some point in time, that property will be worth more than the loan amount. You just need the staying power to get there.
Interesting. So the investors out there who are looking to get into debt, invest in debt is what I mean, expand their debt portfolio. What kind of education should they be doing? What should they be doing to prepare? What do they need to know? What kind of upfront work do they need to do before making a choice?
So I think they have to sort of ask themselves, do they want to be allocated across the full spectrum of real estate investments? And if the answer is yes, then they definitely want debt in their portfolio. It doesn't mean they want only debt. It means that it should be part of their portfolio. And then it's a question of, where do you want to play? Because there's the concept of the efficient frontier in finance, where, you get paid for the risk you're taking. And ideally, you want to make sure you're at least on the line for the efficient frontier, but ideally above it. And today, if I were making that analysis as an investor, I'd be looking for where I could get paid more from a return perspective than the risk I was taking historically. And for us, that is, as I mentioned, industrial and multifamily construction lending. I alluded to the fact that the banks have basically vacated the playing field. Doesn't mean they won't come back, but when they do, it's going to be at a much lower leverage point. That allows us the opportunity as alternative lenders to fill that void, lend less, charge more. So in essence, the way you take less risk when you're a lender is to lend less money. And if you can get paid more for doing that, That is exactly what that's the home run scenario. So in your question, what should they be doing? Some investors may have a lower risk tolerance. Some investors may have tolerance for a little bit more risk. What they should be looking at is the return they're getting relative to the risk they're taking. And we see, frankly, industrial and multifamily construction lending, when we draw our efficient frontier, those two circles are well above that line, which means that we're generating some pretty good alpha for our investors.
So, getting back to default and preventing defaults, does the industry have better tools today to ensure sound loans that don't default, or is it really all the same mechanisms of the past?
There's definitely, well, you say better tools, and I think that's the right way to look at it. The tools were always there, though. Whether or not you got to use them, that's a different story. In a market like, I'll take, for example, the mid-2000s, when, the run-up to the global financial crisis, it's not like lenders didn't know what the tools were. It's just that the market was so competitive, you didn't get to use your tools. And that's what we sort of saw in late 20 and throughout 21, as the market kind of overheated and we all got used to, a cost of debt that was artificially low, it was much harder to use the tools. I think that we believe today we have more ability to use those tools. And by that, I mean put performance covenants in to your loan documents that align the interests of lenders and borrowers a little bit better. Because what you don't want to have happen is I make you a loan today, and then 3 years, 5 years, 10 years later, I show up and say, hey, you're going to pay me off. I find out that the property's been struggling for quite some time, and you hand me the keys back. Ideally, you want to create checkpoints along the way to make sure that your interests are still aligned with your borrowers. And we have a much greater ability to do that today than we did certainly 3 or 4 years ago.
Does artificial intelligence have a play here? I don't mean currently, but it appears that artificial intelligence or AI is applicable to almost anything in life. Do you foresee a day when you're going to be taking a panoply of statistics, metrics, and that are all factored together to give you a clearer view of what's right about an opportunity and what's potentially wrong?
I am 100% certain that artificial intelligence will play a formidable role in the future of real estate and real estate finance. I am less certain about exactly what that looks like, because I think it's still we're sort of in the embryonic stages of it. But there's no doubt that the advent of artificial intelligence will allow us to make better decisions, more informed decisions. It'll allow our borrowers and buyers of real estate to make better and more informed decisions. And that's a good thing for everybody involved. I think that it's still a little early to say exactly how it plays out, but I am 100% certain that it will have a huge impact on our industry going forward.
Now, there are people who talk about commercial real estate being in crisis. Other people say, what's the problem? It's doing fine. Where do you land on that? Is there a crisis going on here? Is everything fine? Is it somewhere in the middle? How would you characterize it?
So I think it's another great question, but I think in answering it, you have to sort of go property type by property type. Multifamily is not in crisis. There's a softening that's occurring, but let's not lose sight of the fact that vacancy rates across the country, even in markets where you think of as ones that are softening, are still relatively low. Industrial, they're even lower. So when I think about those two asset classes, they're very far from a crisis. The other end of the spectrum is office. There is definitely, if it's not a crisis, it's whatever word comes right next to crisis, right? And part of this is just going to take time to play out, but at some point in time, it will no longer be in a crisis. And to me, those are the sort of two ends of the spectrum. You got multifamily and industrial, where it's not, if your best condition in the market's a 10, it's not a 10. If your worst condition's a 1, it's definitely not a 1. It's somewhere probably around, I'll say, 7. Whereas office, you're pretty close to a 2, and maybe in some markets you're at a 3, but that's a huge drop from where it was certainly 5 years ago. So, the industry itself is not in a crisis. The one thing that's different, as we both have alluded to, I've been around a long time, is the amount of capital that's sitting ready to come into our sector once we have more comfort about where stabilized values are. I think that's really the next step. After the global financial crisis, there was an enormous capital void that took a long time to fill. We don't have that void. There's a lot of people ready to come in. Alternative investments have become a huge part of institutional investors' portfolio and high net worth portfolios. That capital's there. We just need to get a little bit of courage of our convictions around values, and that's going to be a big difference between now and what happened at the after the global financial crisis. So I'd say we're pretty far from a crisis, with the exception of maybe the office sector.
So when it comes to private debt, I'll channel Bruce Springsteen here. Are we in glory days right now, or is it something less exhilarating?
At the risk of not using a Bruce Springsteen quote, I'll channel Dickens and say it's the best of times and the worst of times, right? It's the best of times because private debt investors and lenders like us have the ability to be incredibly selective in the loans that we make and get paid really well by historical standards for the risk that we're taking. It's the worst of times because if you've got legacy assets, and we have been in doing this business for a long time, so we clearly have some legacy assets, you have to work through some distress. And that distress may be in the form of vacancy, in the form of softening rents, in the form of value declines that have occurred as a result of higher interest rates and higher cap rates. So you got to work through that distress. So that's the worst of times part of it. I can tell you that from Cross Harbor's perspective, we think we've done a pretty good job of encapsulating our challenging issues, our legacy issues, but it doesn't mean there's not something around the corner and you got to play defense, right? The best of times will be when we can, take all of the energy we're spending on defense right now and go on offense, because right now it's sort of a 50-50 mix. But overall, I would tell you that for the private debt sector like us, it's going to be a really good run for the next, I'll say, 3 to 5 years, as a result of just the macro environment and the fact that there's going to be some challenges from their historical providers of debt capital, like banks and insurance companies.
So what keeps you up at night when you wake up with a sheet soaking wet and a freight train running through the middle of your head, to quote Bruce again? What gets the sheets soaking wet and the freight train going through your head at 3 in the morning?
I have to tell you, that is a very impressive command of the Springsteen repertoire. That is very good. I think, this is going to sound sort of a little bit off the wall, given all the talk and concern about inflation, and that's the right concern right now. But the one that's the freight train is, what happens when we get inflation in check? What will happen to prices? Will they stabilize or will they decline? And if prices start to decline, you have the potential to get into a deflationary environment. And just ask the Japanese how hard it is to get out of a deflationary environment. I am not suggesting that that is a near-term risk. To the contrary, inflation is the risk. But at some point in time, prices will flatten out, and the Fed has to really do a good job of making sure they don't start to decline, because the day you think that the price of a good is going to be cheaper tomorrow is the day you stop buying it today and keep waiting for tomorrow. And that's the freight train. That's the freight
Yeah,
train.
yeah. People don't talk about that a lot, but they, people say if you think inflation's ugly, wait till you see deflation, because it basically undermines everything in our economic system. And well, Europe was there were some countries in Europe that were facing deflation, and which is it's a very scary proposition. So yeah, there's a freight train running through the middle of Richard Fluor's head and a lot of other people's heads. So let me ask you, just in closing, what else do we need to know? What else should investors know about this space that I haven't asked about?
So I think the thing that I would say is that there's a lot of talk about private credit. It's sort of like the hot two words, private credit, private credit. And I'm a big fan of private credit. Don't get me wrong. And I think real estate debt has a very valuable place in the private credit spectrum. But I think, not all private credit is the same. Not all alternative lenders are the same. I think in this environment, it's still one where caution is a pretty good thing to have. And we have it at Cross Harbor in the form of just, making sure that we have a healthy balance of offense and defense at the moment. But if you're thinking about investing in the sector, there's a lot of people out there targeting private credit, real estate credit, and just ask yourself, have they been through a downturn before? And if the answer is no, then just be cautious about, investing with them. Because what I can tell you for certain is we will come out of this downturn. And what I can tell you for certain again is there will be another downturn in the future. What I cannot tell you is when either of those events will occur. But to the extent that you are aligned with someone who knows that A, they're going to happen, and B, has the skill set to help navigate, you're going to end up doing a lot better than if you don't.
My guest has been Richard Fluor, again, Cross Harbor Capital Partners. He's a partner there and portfolio manager, and he is focused on the firm's debt strategies, primarily at this stage, multifamily and industrial, and gave us a lot of good information here. Follow the people, follow the money. That's one of the byways lending money right there. Richard, really appreciate your time. Very clear advice here and information. Thank you for taking the time.
Mike, it was truly a pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation and look forward to hopefully doing it again sometime.